It's like this. And if you sense it coming up, and then put in a micromillimeter or a forward stick, and you want to catch it just right, an extremely difficult thing to do. If he tried to fly the wing off of the runway for that whole takeoff run, I think it would have certainly been a lot more difficult takeoff, and he might have had a failure doing it. So the fact that it scraped on the ground, I think actually made it a safer takeoff.
That's, we probably didn't know it at the time. But my biggest concern was that oscillation, and if it started on the ground, I'd never, the boom take inertia and sitting on the gear, we'd be in an unexplored area trying to dampen out oscillation during the takeoff roll. And when it was down, then I realized that the wings were dragging. My thought was, they're down and they're stable.
Well,
and they're not oscillating.
You didn't know they were on the runway, though. If you would have, you'd have maybe tried to do something about it. Keep in mind, if you look at the Voyager's wing and the fuselage, and he had this little helmet cowl, so he hit his eyes about an inch above the fuselage, so he could look down on that outer wing. The fact that it was way down here on the runway, he couldn't see it at all. But if that wing had been flying and was a foot or foot and a half off of the runway, he could see it. And then he'd have something to work on, something to worry about, right? He had other things to worry about. Can we get to 86 knots to start off with? Because he was 2 knots slow and then 4 knots slow at midfield, whatever the numbers were, I've forgotten.
At midfield, we needed 68 and it was 64.
Yeah.
And Bert made me promise that I would abort like a
blood oath. No way. I just told you that if you get much worse than that, you're going to be in the lake bed. There's no promising going on. I figure that you could figure it out.
Now, you impressed upon me how it was important. If we're not 68.
Yeah, that's right. That's a better, that makes me feel better to describe it like that.
And I can say something, two things.
Think of me making him promise anything to me, and he's 5 years older. I knew more than that.
We had been at this thing for 5.5 years. I frankly was totally dumb beat, physically tired.
Almost as long as I've taken to design a stupid little seaplane.
And when I released brakes that morning, I says, I am not, Mom says, I was not about ready to board. I didn't care what the hell happened. All I wanted was this bloody thing over with. Some way I wanted it over with. Thing, too, is that I finally realized that all the problems we had with this airplane, with the pitch oscillation and many other things, that the chances of surviving this thing was going to be questionable. Questionable, right? That the chances of surviving it, what the hell are we doing? We got this flimsy little airplane and Mother Nature's thunderstorms in the subtropical equator area. Yeah, what could go wrong? We got to go across Africa where the thunderstorms are. What's the chances of surviving this thing? And so I was so worried about that. I looked around at all these volunteers that came and worked for nothing. A lot of talented people that came and helped this thing for communication and so forth. And I thought, if we go out and do an Amelia Earhart, these people are going to feel really bad. So I made a death tape. I went out in the end of the runway, runway 1-2 at Mojave, looking down the runway. And I says, well, Cecil B. DeMille Dick, I'm going to set this up. So he set it up on a tripod and he started the video camera. And I told my manager, I said, you set it up and start running and I want you to leave. From down the runway, Gene and I walked up to the runway, right up the camera, and we had two messages to tell him. And this is just after the Challenger, and I was incensed that the survivors of those 7 brave astronauts that died in the space shuttle, they had the audacity to sue the country that they gave their life for. And that was my first message. I says, hey guys, we know that this is a dangerous project. We all knew that. And if any one of you even think about suing anybody over this, Gene and I will come back and haunt you, your kids, and your grandkids. So please do not disgrace this program by doing that. And I says another thing is that we didn't make it. But you, as one of the volunteers that worked on this thing, and there was a lot of you, you should be damn proud of it. You shouldn't feel that it was any part of your fault, because I know every single one of you did your absolute very best job for this project. And although it didn't work this time, you should walk away with your head up and be darn proud of the fact that you came here on this day and you tried to do something, and it didn't work. And I says, we'll see some of you later, and maybe a few of you much later. And we turned around and walked down the runway and just faded off to the side.
Yeah, now we had a... In setting up the redundancy and the system safety analysis in the airplane, we had a criteria that it's all right to have a single point of failure on a system as long as they can get to land and recover, no accident, and could try again. But if something could cause a fatal accident, we had to put redundancy for it. Okay? I want to talk to you about another thing that Dick talked about, the chances of survivability, the chances that he and Gina would come back alive, bottom line, or that the airplane wasn't out there broken in pieces in the Pacific or Atlantic. Another thing that we had in mind, when I say we, I'm talking about Bruce and me, the other people working on it, that were working a different problem than Dick. And that was, what are the chances on the first attempt that it'll actually make it around, that it'll be successful? And we had several criteria that said, and it's based on real data, that said it's unlikely that this flight will be successful. Okay, and I'd like to name what they were. First of all, reliability. That airplane had flown 340 flight hours, when 67 flights.
68 flights, 360 flight hours.
Okay.
It doesn't matter.
That airplane had flown 360 flight hours and 68 flights, yep. before the world flight. 360 hours, that's quite a bit of flying. But we were planning, the flight plan was 225 hours. A couple of years of flying, 68 flights, a total of 340. We're planning one flight of 225 hours and almost all of it over ocean. And during the 68 flights and 340 flight hours of flight test, there were at least four occasions when the airplane had to return and land with a problem that it couldn't maintain altitude. Okay? Now think about it. Four times in 340, you got one flight in 225, and almost all of it are over oceans. Not very good statistics there. Mechanical reliability data from us showed us the flight was less than 50% likely to happen. And there was another thing that Dick doesn't like to talk about.
You're wrong.
But the data, actually you didn't.
No, about the yesterday, fact that I was going to fail?
No, yesterday in the museum, I heard you for the first time agree that you wanted to burn the airplane in Salina because you were too tired to get it to Oshkosh. Okay, now here's the thing. When I laid out a suggested flight test plan to do, initial flight tests were run by RAF at a certain point of the program when we say this airplane has world flight capability. And we did that with Junker 0235s, wooden propellers. Then we turned the program over from Dick, and he did all the flight planning, and he did everything after that. Put in the world flight engines, the avionics, and did all the flight tests needed for the world flight. So there was kind of demarcation, RAF and Voyager. During that RAF part, I had laid out a program where, assuming that the airplane was reliable to fly, at each flight, the duration, we'd make it an extra day. something like the third flight where we're going to fly it overnight, and the fourth flight we're going to fly for 2 days, and the fifth flight we're going to fly for 3 days. That was on it, right? And we actually, on a lot of the early flights, on the flight card, it said, we do these tests, get this speed power, do this systems data, do all of these things, and then fly into darkness, one of you sleep at a time, and come back and land in the morning, right? So they go up and flight the flight card, everything's fine, and it's getting dark, and there's a Voyager coming into land. Well, what's the matter? That always occurred if there was a little bit of turbulence, because the turbulence ride and the frequencies in which it did was very nauseous. Makes you sick. I mean, it was tough. I know I couldn't do it.
I asked you once.
But here's something that you got to listen to very carefully. A few months before the world flight, the airplane actually flew 4.5 days, a flight to set the world's closed course distance record by going back and forth between Santa Barbara and San Francisco off the coast. It did that whole flight of 4.5 days in essentially smooth air. That flight, just a few months before the world flight, was the first flight that anybody slept in the Voyager.